You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Elizabeth Warren takes on Eric Holder. He came right out and said these banks have become too big to jail. And she says that is proof that they're also too big to fail, and it's time to get rid of them. It's really interesting. You go back to the beginning of American history. George Washington, Austin Peterson's going to join us in just a second. George Washington asked Alexander Hamilton, his Secretary of the Treasury, what do the words general welfare mean in the Constitution? After all, you help write it, you help sell it. And in his report on manufacturers, Hamilton says the term general welfare was doubtless intended to signify more than was expressed or imported in those which preceded, was the power to raise money, in other words, tax and spend. More significant than what was expressed or imported in those which preceded. Otherwise, numerous exigencies incident to the affairs of a nation would have been left without a provision. The phrase is as comprehensive as any that could have been used because it was not fit that the constitutional authority of the Union to appropriate its revenue should have been restricted within narrower limits than the general welfare, and because this necessarily embraces a vast variety of particulars which are susceptible neither of specification nor of definition. It is therefore of necessity left to the discretion of the national legislature to pronounce upon the objects which concern the general welfare and for which, under that description, an appropriation of money is requisite and proper. And it seems to be no room for a doubt that whatever concerns the general interests of learning, of agriculture, of manufacture, and of commerce are within the sphere of the national councils, as well as regards any application of money. And then, speaking of money, in Federalist Number 10, we have James Madison talking about a landed interest, a manufacturing interest, a mercantile interest, a moneyed interest. In other words, he's talking about landholders, manufacturers, retailers, and bankers. And many lesser interests grow of necessity in civilized nations. The regulation of these various and interfering interests forms the principal task of modern legislation. It is the necessary and ordinary operation of the government. So, too big to fail banks? Austin Peterson, founder and publisher of LibertarianRepublic.com, director of production at FreedomWorks. Which is the website here, Austin? AustinPeterson.com. Aha, yeah. There you go. Okay.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Austin. Okay, so here we have banks doing exactly what numerous economists from Adam Smith to Karl Marx, Adam Smith and his Theory of Moral Sentiments, Karl Marx and Das Kapital, all of them described, without the regulation of government, within a sector, large corporations will eat small corporations until there's only one, two, or three of those corporations left, and they function as a cartel. Government is necessary to enforce competition. Is it time to break up these too-big-to-jail banks, or are they going to bring down capitalism?
Good question. I mean, I actually think we might be able to find an area of agreement here, Tom, because what you're really talking about, the problem there is corporatism. It's the special favors afforded to banks that make them too big to fail. It's the bailouts and things like that. You've seen a few.
I'm not talking about that. In fact, if you allow the banks to fail, I'm not a fan of bailing out the banks. I think that we should have done what Ronald Reagan did and nationalized the banks. But if you instead did nothing and you let the banks fail, what Herbert Hoover did in 1929, 1930, 1931, 1932, and the first 3 months of 1933, if you do what Herbert Hoover did and what Republicans are talking about, and certainly libertarians are talking about now, what you would end up with, and what we did end up with in the 30s as a consequence of that, was that all these small banks, when they failed, got bought up for pennies on the dollars by big banks, and you ended up with basically Andrew Mellon owning the country.
Right. Well, what you want to do is to give institutions like banks the incentives to do right by their customers. Because what we have right now, banks are not incentivized to do right by their customers. Take a look at interest rates. Interest rates are the lowest that they've ever been in history, and they've been low for, I think, the longest that they've ever been in history. So what the problem with that is that it incentivizes banks to not take care of the little guy, because what it does is they go and they run up all of this debt from other major financial institutions, and they're not as incentivized to do things like hand out loans to lower income or minorities.
So how would you have big government incentivize the banks?
Well, what I would do is I would break up the largest banking cartel that we have.
So you want to use big government to break up the big banks?
Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to break up the banking cartel in the way of abolishing our central bank. So if you really wanted to make...
But the central bank has nothing to do with the fact that Citicorp is the result of the acquisition of over 100 other banks.
Let me finish. So what we want to do as libertarians, if we want banks to be forced to compete, we want them to be able to set their own interest rates. So what we would do is that we would abolish the central bank and we would allow regional banks to compete against one another. That way, if banks do fail, it doesn't take the entire economy with it. It could be a regionalized problem where maybe perhaps Detroit, the banking system in Detroit gave out too many poor loans, but the banking system in New York wouldn't have done that. They won't have to take that kind of a risk. Right now, what we've set ourselves up with is a too big to fail, one size fits all.
What you're describing, Austin, and I'm guessing you have to be a student of this history, is what happened after Andrew Jackson destroyed the Second Bank of the United States. And what it led to was a period of time from that time until 1935 when never once during that entire period of time did we go more than 15 years without a major national bank panic, without a major national bank failure. It caused these cycles of boom and bust because these banks were not regulated.
But we didn't have great depressions and great recessions.
You had a depression from 1878 until 1898 that was far worse than the Great Depression of the 1930s.
You're complaining about capitalism and the features of capitalism because you have to understand that capitalism means profit and loss. So there do have to be institutions that sometimes take a loss because they made bad decisions. If someone makes bad decisions,
it's our money.
It doesn't matter. No, it's not your money. What's your money is your money. What's other people's money is other people's.
I'm talking about is us as a nation. It is our money as a nation. Money is the medium of exchange that we as a nation have decided to use. And when you totally privatize it and you locally privatize it, what you do is you create these boom and bust cycles as banks try to compete with each other, end up buying each other, end up overreaching, end up collapsing.
When you nationalize it, what you get is the Soviet Empire. You understand?
No, when you nationalize it, what you get is what we had in the United States from 1935 until 1999 under Glass-Steagall. Not one single banking collapse. Not one.
The central bank is the creator of the business cycle. It is the problem. If you want to...
Business cycle was worse before we had a central bank, although I would argue that the central bank has very little to do with the business cycle.
The central bank has a lot to do with the business cycle. They're the ones who are printing the money.
Then how do you account for the business cycle being so severe that from the Washington administration until the Wilson administration... Well, until the second Roosevelt administration, we never went more than 15 years without a major national banking crash.
Because you never go anywhere without having, sometimes you have a loss. You have to understand, Tom, that you cannot always have a permanent boom. There's no such thing.
Okay, so we're talking in circles here, Austin. You're saying that there's an upside and a downside to capitalism. I'm agreeing with you, and if we were talking about manufacturing socks, I'd have no problem with, occasionally socks manufacturers going out of business and we all have to wear the same socks for 2 years. But we're talking about our money supply. We're talking about banks. We're talking about people's savings. We're talking about people on the edge of retirement being wiped out. We're talking about young people going into life with nothing.
Well, but that's because of the central bank. It's not because of the regional bank.
No,
regional
this happened track. Long before we had a central bank.
We've had three central banks, so you can't take...
Well, it happened continuously during the intervening period from the Andrew Jackson administration when the second central bank was killed off until 1913 when the most recent one was created.
No, it's a bunch of lies and propaganda. That's right there.
Austin, go back and look!
Is it break time now?
It is break time. I think we've both made our points. We'll let our viewers go to DuckDuckGo machines and Google machines and figure out which is what, I guess. Austin Peterson, and of course you can read all about it at AustinPetersonSEN.com's website. Thank you, Austin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed. So what do we do? Well, I don't think, doing away with the central bank is the be-all and end of this. I think that we need to regulate these banks. This is where, and welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. This is where libertarianism completely disintegrates. It just completely disintegrates. There's no argument that libertarians can make when it comes to anything that touches the commons, the general welfare of the United States. and money and our money supply and how our money supply is used absolutely touches all of us. And which is why Alexander Hamilton argued at the creation of this country that we should have a national bank. We did have a national bank. It ultimately failed because there's a big battle about it. I mean, you know, it failed in the 1820s. It was replaced by the Second National Bank. And that one failed Andrew Jackson drove a stake through its heart. He campaigned on killing it off, and he killed it off because, you know, these were not, by the way, central banks like the Fed. They were simply national banks. But they were independent of the government or the quasi-government authorities. But they didn't regulate our money supply. They simply provided a clearinghouse for all the other banks to operate through. So I guess you could say in a way they operated like a central bank. But the net of this was that it's not the central banks, it's not the Fed, it wasn't the First National Bank, it wasn't the Second National Bank, it wasn't any of that that produces the business cycle. It's laissez-faire capitalism, it's unregulated capitalism that produces the business cycle. It's the nature of capitalism. And to say that we should have absolutely unregulated capitalism, as libertarians say, is basically to say two things. Number one, you're going to condemn people for the rest of their lives to the whims and vagaries of the very rich and the very powerful who can make it through the business cycle and who in large part are driving the business cycle. Because basically they'll go greed, 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 crash, greed, 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 crash, greed, 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 crash. And those crashes literally from the George Washington administration until Franklin Roosevelt passed the Glass-Steagall Act and heavily regulated the banks. We never went more than 15 years in the founding of this country until 1936. We never went more than 15 years without a national bank panic. And from 1935 or 36, whichever year Glass-Steagall was passed, actually, I'm pretty sure it was 35, from 1935 until 1998, when Glass-Steagall was repealed by Graham Leach Bliley, by Phil Graham's legislation. And it was repealed because Phil Graham's wife, Wendy, had been on the board of Enron, and Ken Lay of Enron wanted to be a banker as well as an energy baron. And as soon as Glass-Steagall was repealed, what did you have 10 years later? The banks crashed. A bank panic. This is not rocket science. This is, you can look this stuff up. The closest we had to a banking panic in the period from 1935 to 2008, the closest thing we had to a bank panic that affected us nationally was the S&L crisis in 1986, and that was brought on by Ronald Reagan deregulating the S&Ls in 1982. It was 1986 that they crashed. And what was Reagan's response to the S&L crisis? He nationalized them. Bill Seidman was the guy that he put in charge of that. We used to have a whole collection of Seidman clips. I don't know if you can easily find those, Shano. Bill Seidman died a couple of years ago, but he started a college in Grand Rapids, and he was quite elderly, but quite sharp. He was in his, as I recall, his mid to late 80s at the time when he was, he came to Grand Rapids. He lived in the neighborhood. Came to this college that he had helped start to give a talk, and it was right at the crisis. It was right during the banking panic. And the question was asked, you know, how'd this happen? What did you guys learn from the S&L crisis? And what's going on now, and what can be done about it? And Bill Seidman, this Republican, had an absolutely brilliant analysis of it. And just laid it all out. Did you find any of those clips, Shane? You got them? Why don't you just let's fire off a couple and see what he had to say. They're all generally on the same theme. They do build in a particular order, but what do you got?
What is tranche credit rated securitization? What it simply means is you take a bunch of mortgages.
Pause this for a second.
You put.
He's in this clip. He is admitting that he invented the thing that ultimately brought down the whole banking system, but he invented it for a good purpose. It's how they unwound the SNLs. Let's start that one again.
What is tranched credit rated securitization? What it simply means is you take a bunch of mortgages, you put them into a trust, and then you divide the trust up into sections, and you say the first section, all the mortgages will support payment of interest on the first section. And then after they're paid, you go to the second, then the third, and then there's a residual piece. That is the way that these mortgages, subprime mortgages, were put together, and then these pieces were sold all over the world. I remember when we invented this, Alan Greenspan said, well, this is a great new innovation because we are spreading the risk all over the world, which, of course, is what we did, and for which, at this point, the world is, to say the least, blaming the whole financial crisis we're in on us.
There you go. And he points out that when they tranched the bad SNL loans and then sold them off, nobody got burned. It wasn't a bad thing. But what happened was when the banks were deregulated in 1998, 1999, whatever year Gramm-Leach-Bliley was passed, when the banksters were deregulated and they went nuts and they started selling these tranched securities, these pieces, that we generated $800-900 trillion worth of this debt worldwide, and it just brought down the worldwide banking system. 27 minutes past the hour. I want to share a little more Bill Seidman with you, and we'll pick up your calls, your thoughts on this, too. I see you're slammed. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Isn't it time that we take back our banking system the way other countries have done, like Sweden did or like Reagan did with the SNLs, rather than going the libertarian road? Welcome back. So we're talking about, you know, how did we get in this banking mess? What happened? Bill Seidman, the guy who, when we first cut these clips up, he was still alive. We tried to get him on the program, but my recollection is we were not able to, that he was not doing media, but he died shortly after the speech, actually. And it's Seidman. And I was pronouncing it Seidman, but somebody from Grand Rapids who knew him called and corrected me and said it's pronounced Seidman, even though it looks like Seidman. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that person was wrong. But in any case, here's Seid. Here is Bill talking about what happened during the financial crisis. Here's another clip from one of his speeches.
It was proposed that their regulation, or at least disclosure, be required. And the industry fought it, and the Federal Reserve, under Alan Greenspan, vehemently opposed. And they made the argument, which you hear all the time, and I can remember Alan and saying,
Alan the Libertarian.
Look, these are sophisticated contracts between knowledgeable buyers and knowledgeable sellers. No regulator can do as well as they'll do. So what do you need a regulator for? The market will regulate these. And he won the day. So among the list of our friends, along with me and others, Alan was clearly, I'd say, the key person responsible for the fact that we didn't even know how many of those contracts there were, and they were up in the trillions. So when AIG got in trouble, it turned out that they had one division with 400 people in it. They had 80,000 employees. They had 400 people in one division. They wrote all these contracts. They didn't report any of them. So they were, you'd say, gambling by writing these contracts. And when things started to go bad and they had to pay on these contracts, the whole monster, the largest insurance company in the world, went under.
And we bailed out AIG dollar for dollar. And why? Because the Prince AIG was the insurance company that was backstopping the banks that were doing the bad loans. And the biggest one of those banks that would have gone down if we didn't bail out AIG was Goldman Sachs. And Henry Paulson, who was our Treasury Secretary under the Bush administration at that time, was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, and he was not going to let that happen. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. Bill Seidman, he had a lot of wisdom. He had a lot to do. This is the Republican who ran the Resolution Trust Corporation, who cleaned up the SNL disaster, who nationalized the SNLs, fired all the executives, put in their place banking regulators, all the members of the boards of directors. They all lost everything. Their stock became worth nothing. They were nationalized by Reagan. And then over the course of the next two decades, Bill Seidman sold them back into the private sector, re-regulated. And there's been no problem with the SNL since then. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, you wanted to talk about Sweden doing the same.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, there was a gap there. Yeah, I just wanted to say that, Sweden did have a lot of success in their banking crisis by nationalizing the banks. I think they even made money on it. I don't know the mechanics of it, but maybe you have more knowledge.
I do. I can tell you. This was in 1998, and they had there had been a laissez-faire period that went back to the 70s in Sweden. And they had been flirting with deregulating their banks, and they had done it to some extent. Their banks crashed in 1998, and they just said, screw it, we're going to do what Reagan did in 1986 with the SNLs. They nationalized them. They took them over. All the stockholders lost everything in the bank, all the stockholders in the banks. The depositors in the banks were protected by the Swedish government, so the little guy didn't get screwed. And the management of the banks were all fired, and they were replaced by banking regulators. And then slowly over the next few years, and I believe that the Swedish banks are now re-privatized, they started re-privatizing them, selling them back. They basically did the exact same thing the Reagan administration did with the SNLs. So, and as you point out correctly, it worked out really well. Robert in Mission Viejo, California. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yeah. Hey, I just wanted to point out how crazy libertarians really are, because the free market rests on a foundation of public infrastructure. If it weren't for the public infrastructure, there wouldn't be any free market at all.
That's correct.
So when they say we can't pay taxes, we can't pay for public infrastructure, they're saying let's just chop the foundation right out from under ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, I mean, think about it. If you're a business and you're thinking of locating someplace, would you want to locate in a country, state, city, where there's good public infrastructure, where there's good mass transit, where there's good road systems, where there's plenty of parking, where there's good high-speed internet services, where telephone service can be instantly installed, where there's a, you know, a functioning and high-quality police and fire service, where the schools are really high-quality, where basically all that core infrastructure stuff is there and is working? Would you want to locate there? Or would you rather locate, which could be, you know, like Portland, Oregon? I mean, this is a city, the most planned city in the United States. And by the way, doing very well, thank you very much. Would you want to locate there, or would you want to locate in some place like, you know, some town in Somalia where there's no infrastructure, there's no nothing? And this is what China figured out 30 years ago. They said, we've got to build out the infrastructure if we're going to become a player in the international world. It's what India is going through right now. And you're right. The libertarians are saying, government's got no role in this. Let the private industry do it. In fact, they even go so far as to say we should privatize our roads. They're in the process of privatizing our schools. And tragically, you got a bunch of Democrats and a bunch of corporatists, you know, Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation and all these people, and Arne Duncan and hopping on this bandwagon of privatizing the schools. Let's privatize our water systems. About half of them are privatized. Let's privatize our power systems. A little less than half of them have been privatized. And what it does is it devastates that core infrastructure. Excellent point, Robert. Thank you for calling and making it. John in San Jose, California. Hey, John. Atlas Shrugged has already happened.
Yes. I was listening to a documentary on migrations in Latin America, and it occurred to me that Atlas Shrugged already happened. It happened in Cuba. the whole premise of...
Oh, you mean all the rich guys left town?
Yeah. All of them left town, and they waited for the country to melt down, implode, explode, whatever, so they could move in and take over again. And even with massive challenges by the world plutocrats, Cuba still made a nice country to live without the plutocrats.
Right. And every kid goes to school. They turn out more doctors than any other country in the world. Everybody has a home to live in. Everybody has, you know, nobody's hungry. Everybody has medical care from cradle to grave. You could argue that there are some things that Castro is doing that, you know, we're not all that pleased about, his limits on free speech and such. Although, well, yeah, I'm not even going to try to defend him in that regard. But the point is that with regard to capital and capitalism, and Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged, and the whole premise of Atlas Shrugged, who is John Galt? John Galt's the, you know, one of the billionaires who said, that's it. I'm sick and tired of the labor unions pestering me for higher wages, and I'm sick and tired of the government trying to regulate how much smokestacks stuff goes out of my railroads, or whether or not this new steel I've invented, you know, is safe or not. And so we're going to leave town, and the whole country falls into chaos as a consequence of it. And it's a fantasy. It's literally a novel, and it's a novel that demonstrates something that has never existed. You're right. Cuba is a great example. Atlas Shrugged in Cuba, and arguably, well, you know, in Venezuela there's still a lot of rich people. So Cuba's probably the purest example out there. Thank you for that, John. I appreciate the call. Thank you, Dustin. In Maryland Heights, Missouri. Hey, Dustin. You wanted to talk about modern money theory?
Yeah, I'm loving it. I've been obsessed with my research. The interview yesterday with Randall Ray was great. I learned a lot from that. And James Galbraith would be a great guy to have on your program, too.
Yeah, Janie Galbraith is next on my hit list. We're you know, our creating our list for Sean of the people that, you know, my hit parade, I should say, not hit list.
Yeah, I'm learning a lot from all of them. My question is, my research in MMT, I really find it kind of a paradox and kind of frustrating as we talk about the Bretton Woods system, the breakdown of Bretton Woods when Nixon took us off the gold standard in 71. It's really been kind of a double-edged sword in terms of its effects on the economy. It's been positive in the sense that the MMT guys explained that allowed the currency to be free-floating and we're more flexible. But the negative effect is really the origin of Reaganomics. And Noam Chomsky has been talking about this for years, is that the fact that it was designed to be able, for national governments to be able to control their domestic economies in it. It constrained capital flight, and once you broke down that system, that's when you had the financialization of the economy, the rampant speculation, the breakdown of the manufacturing sector. Like I said, it's really the, you know, Reaganomics started in 81, but really the origin was really in 1971 when it broke down the Bretton Woods system. That's what I find kind of frustrating, kind of a paradox, is that you know, for years I'm saying it's been a horrible event when this occurred in 1971, but now it's...
I would say that was not the result of closing the gold window, that was more the result of a gradual process that began in the late 70s. Jimmy Carter bought into this and then went on steroids in the 90s. Of deregulating both banking and industry and trade.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then we started adopting really, really stupid trade policies. But it's a good question that if we can get Jamie Galbraith or anybody else, any of these MMT folks on, I will ask. Thank you for the call, Dustin. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. One of our callers today, by the way, is going to receive a free autographed copy of my book, Cracking the Code. It's my book on neurolinguistic programming, NLP, as applied to politics, Cracking the Political Code. And it will be sent out courtesy of stamps.com. That caller could be you. Eric in Denver. Hey, Eric. You want to talk about Fannie and Freddie?
Yeah, I had a question about that. I'm a new listener. I'm kind of a moderate conservative, kind of with an open mind. I was wondering, do you place any blame for that crisis on the changes in the underwriting standards that Fannie and Freddie, since they finance a large part of these subprime mortgages, did they not? Or?
Yeah, they did. They provided the backstopping of the funding. In other words, the banks would write them and Fannie and Freddie would guarantee them. Or in some cases, pass the money through to the banks, yes. Yeah, and I absolutely blame them. Fannie and Freddie had been privatized, and I'd have to consult some sort of reference site to figure out when they were privatized. But they used to be government agencies, And as government agencies, they operate on a very conservative basis and a very rigid set of rules. And they allowed the banking system to participate in loans and lending for mortgages in a way that somewhat reduced the risk to the banks, you know, nationalized, as it were, the risk. But in exchange for nationalizing that risk, the banks had to operate within very narrow parameters. And they had to give loans that were good. When we semi-privatized Fannie and Freddie and started selling stock in Fannie and Freddie, and Fannie and Freddie became money-making operations that were spinning off dividends to their shareholders, there was all this incentive for Fannie and Freddie to behave like any other for-profit corporation and do whatever it takes to make money. And you're right. At that point, they loosened the rules under which they would backstop the banks. I think it was a horrible mistake to partially privatize them. They should have either been totally privatized and let them go like AIG, and when the whole thing crashes, let them die, or they should have been kept a federal government agency. And I continue to believe that.
Quickly,
yeah.
What is your general idea about, you're not for complete socialism, are you? You seem to be for kind of a mixture, or...
Well, it depends on how you define socialism. By my understanding...
Well, you don't want government control of the means of production, or...
No, of course not. I'm not a Karl Marx socialist, a communist. I want my jeans, my computer, you know, my copy machine. I want those made by private industry. I want to be able to participate in that private industry. This program is a product that I own in private industry. I've been an entrepreneur my entire life. I've never been a capitalist. You know, Mitt Romney right now is a capitalist. A capitalist is a person who lives off money by investing money. But I've always been an entrepreneur, and I believe in entrepreneurship, which is typically a subset of capitalism, although not always. But I also believe that
I believe in money, but how do you draw that distinction between, you know, it's necessary for the private sector to make money,
right,
but there's no private sector. So how do you seem to demonize profits, but
no,
they seem to be required for the system to work, don't they?
The only time I demonize profits is when they are done on the back of the commons. There are, and this is how typically democratic socialist countries, and the United States is one, nobody's going to acknowledge it, but we are one, as are all of the modern democracies. All 34 members of the OECD are all democratic socialist countries. Most of them call themselves that. Germany calls themselves that. France calls themselves that. Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland. You can go through the list. They call themselves that. And the way that you do it is you say, is this the commons or not? If there is a natural monopoly, if it is not possible for a marketplace to have in a natural state competition, for example, then that's part of the commons. For example, how many water pipes can you have coming into your house? One, right?
So
water's a natural monopoly. So it makes no sense to have five water companies competing in your community, and thus improving the quality of water by competition. It's never going to happen. So a natural monopoly, like water, like power, like sewage, should be either run by the government so that it's run by people who are answerable to us and we can fire them at the ballot box and we can make sure that they're doing their jobs. It should either be run by people answerable to us or run by, if you're going to semi-privatize it, run by heavily regulated industries who are answerable to us first, and their shareholders second.
It's kind of the way we do it now. They're heavily regulated, but I think that the management should be, like
not.
You say, they may be semi-privatized.
Yeah. Well, no, it's about half of all the power in the United States and a little less than half of all the water in the United States is now completely, or not completely, it is totally privatized in terms of ownership and largely privatized in terms of regulation, although there are standards of regulation that, you know, your current has to be 60 cycles and it has to have a certain level of cleanliness and the water has to be a certain level of cleanliness that are enforced nationwide. I think that that's a good thing. Now, you can call that socialism. That's what I would call socialism, democratic socialism.
Well, I think that's obviously there are roles of government plays like that that are
sure
definitely necessary.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
as an employer, I want to be able to hire people who are, you know, who know how to read and write and are competent and functional. And I think that is something that you can't expect every family to be able to pay for their child's education. I think that, you know, we should join the rest of the world and say education from kindergarten through PhD is basically the cost of society. It's an investment by society. We know from the experience of the GI Bill that when we invest a dollar in the college education of a young person, and it was mostly young men in the late 40s through the end, the mid 60s was when the GI Bill basically ended. That when we invest a dollar in the college education of somebody, throughout their lifetime, we make back between $7 and $15, depending on how you calculate it and who's doing the calculations, just in tax revenue, just in additional tax revenue.
Would you acknowledge there is some upward limit to that? In other words, you can't just keep pouring in dollars and automatically expect it to magically expand.
Of course.
That there are some limitations on the educability of some individuals.
Well, what Germany does is they say you're entitled to an education that'll get you into the workforce. And if you can qualify for college, you can get college. If you can qualify for trade school, you get trade school. And this decision, by the way, is made in grade school. And they have different high schools, one that leads to college and one that leads to trade schools. And if you don't qualify for either one, then, you know, we'll figure out something for you. But it, you know, even janitors actually have to go through an apprenticeship in Germany. So, and Eric, Shano tells me that you're going to get a copy of Cracking the Code. You are the winner of our book today. So I'm going to put you on hold here so that Danielle can pick you up. Eric's on line two. And we'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mike Papantonio on the line with us, the attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio and Ring of Fire TV, now on Free Speech TV. And you can find out all the information on that at ringoffireradio.com. Do I have that right, Pap?
You do.
Okay. Mike Papantonio, welcome. So glad to have you with us here. A couple things I want to talk with you about. I wanted to get into this whole, you know, guns and in this town in Georgia. We went through this when I lived in Atlanta, and Kennesaw did something similar. But first, Eric Holder has made some news after Rand Paul's 13-hour grandstand stunt yesterday. Although I praise his position, the president should not be able to play judge or jury. That, in fact, in a capital case, Fifth Amendment says it has to be a jury. It can't even be a judge. But finally, we got this letter today. Literally, dear Senator Paul, it has come to my attention that you have now asked an additional question, quote, does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on American soil, end quote, with a question mark. The answer, Eric Holder writes, to that question is no. Pap, I'm curious your take on the evolution of this, the original letter, the original response, and how the Republicans ended up with the high ground on this.
Well, the point is, Holder said what he had in his mind is truth the first time. I mean, this is the arena that they've operated under, Tom. This is a Department of Justice that there's no surprise coming from Eric Holder. Listen, if you look at who's advising this president right now, for them to suggest that it's completely appropriate to kill an American on American soil with a drone, that really is not a shocker. It's not a surprise. It would have been astounding to me just 4 years ago, but it's not anymore. So I think somebody said, you know, Eric, I can't believe you said that. Either you weren't thinking or you weren't protecting what you were thinking. And so this follow-up letter is simply a way to have some wiggle room on that issue.
But, yeah. And Rand Paul is now claiming victory, as, you know, although there were a couple of Democrats. Ron Wyden was the first among them to step up and say, yeah, we're concerned about drones being used domestically, yeah, too. But in his original letter, Holder said, yeah, I can imagine a couple of scenarios where it might be possible. One was Pearl Harbor and the other was 9/11. And, you know, I've heard that there was a conversation where Dick Cheney was talking about shooting down the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. And I don't know if that's part of the 9/11 lore or if that's part of actual news.
Tom, the big problem here is that there are no guidelines, and Holder knows there are no guidelines. And, you know, for even for this president to be saying, rush these guidelines, give us some guidelines on where drones can be used, give us some do's and don'ts. You know, he's been saying that, but he realizes there's not going to be any meaningful activity on that anytime soon. And so it's lip service. We're not going to have a roadmap that really means anything for years. Mm. And you know the statistics just as well as I do. Within the private industry, we're going to have private drones flying all over America, 30,000 of them, within the next 10 years. And so it's time. It's simply time.
Yeah, and let me add to that, Pap. I believe that with regard to drones, we are right now where we were with IBM mainframes. Back when I was going to college in the late 60s, where you know I had to organize a stack of cards a foot and a half high to program a little if and or loop, in BASIC, or no, it wasn't even BASIC. It was Fortran, as I recall. And the card reader. I mean, the computer occupied a room.
Exactly.
And now I've got more computing power than that the entire MSU computing department had in 1968. I got more power than that in my iPhone.
In other words, once you put it in the air and it's flying, then all of a sudden technology just makes these giant leaps.
Yeah, and pretty soon you got a drone that's the size of a dragonfly.
Well, they're not far from that already. The other part of it is, if you recall during that era that you're talking about, technology was ahead of the law. Technology was ahead of the game, the rules of the game, and that's what we have here. Technology is way, way ahead. Only with IBM, you probably weren't going to kill anybody. There wasn't going to be human death because of it. Here you're going to have human death where we don't have any rules or regulations at all.
Although you could argue that, IBM providing the Nazi government with the computer system to keep track of who was sent to which death camps, that really should have been regulated.
Ugly story.
Yeah, it was a very ugly story. Pap, gun laws. We have states are getting very strict on guns, fewer guns, fewer gun-related deaths. This is from the Daily Beast, a study that they're publishing on. But at the same time, we've got this wackadoodle legislator in a city in Georgia that's saying, guns for everybody.
Yeah, well, I got to say, Tom, last night I was at a town hall meeting for Sinclair Broadcasting, asked me to be the constitutional lawyer on the left on this issue. And I said, this issue really isn't about the Constitution. This issue is about the story, for example, that you were about to tell about Georgia legislator that said it's going to be mandatory that people in this town carry a gun. And here's the way I see this. The NRA and the good guys with guns are losing their brand. And that's an issue that's far more important than anything constitutional. Constitutional issues are transient. You're going to have Rehnquist one day court, a Warren court, and then you're going to have a Scalia-Roberts kind of court. It's going to change all the time. But anytime you have a backlash where you have them losing their high ground brand, they've got a problem. There's several things that are happening right now, Tom. The NRA is losing natural, just the evolution of things because it's losing its logical base. You have a natural base of hunters and sportsmen that are being replaced by this more militant fringe. You have an age demographic that's rapidly changing in age between 18 and 35, and you see gun issues that are looked at much different. They don't buy the idea that government is here to take anybody's guns and we have to arm ourselves against the government. That is an older generation kind of thought. The demographics on urban population are shifting, Tom. You've got rural America that used to, that's where we used to do hunting. That's where you would find more guns. Now in places like Chicago and L.A., they have a different attitude. Plenty of guns there, but it's a different attitude of who has the high ground. And I think there's more recognition of how overreaching and arrogant the industry's become. Hogs get fat, pigs get slaughtered, and that's what's getting ready to happen to the gun industry. They've seen greed and overreaching surround this industry. They've seen total immunity for sales, as we've talked about. They've seen blocked research efforts to try to research what's the connection between guns and violence. They've seen the ATF being blocked by having a crime registry with guns that are used in crime. They've had initiated expansion on carry rights in schools and parks virtually everywhere. So the public is reacting to that. And, I've seen it before, Tom. I've been involved with it before. I was involved in tobacco, where tobacco thought that they were bulletproof. They overreached. They became arrogant. And we used to tell them again and again as discovery was taking place, you know what? Hogs get fat, pigs get slaughtered. We saw the same thing with the automobile industry where they said we don't need seat belts. They resisted it for 20 years. Same thing with airbags. Same thing with children's car restraints. So we've seen when an industry overreaches and loses sight that it doesn't make any difference what happens in the courts when you have a public outrage that reaches the level that we're looking at now, where 90% of the American public that don't have any relationship with the gun industry, they don't understand why a person needs an AK-47 to defend themselves or why they need armor-piercing bullets that kill police officers while they're driving around in their police cars, why we need those things. They think if they can defend themselves, they can probably do it with a 9mm Glock. If they want to hunt birds, they can probably do that with a Winchester 12-gauge. So that's the way it's fallen. It's not good for the NRA right now.
Yeah, and which is a good thing for Americans.
Yes.
Mike Papantonio, attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio and Ring of Fire TV, now on Free Speech TV. You can read all about both of them over at ringoffireradio.com. Pap, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, John.
Good, always good talk. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Rand Paul's filibuster. I want to share some more thoughts on that. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. This was a stunt, but he picked the right topic. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Hey, it's our Geeky Science Minute, or two, or maybe three at the most. My opportunity to get geeky. Let's talk about salt. For years, doctors and nutritionists have been telling us to cut back on salt to reduce the risk of heart problems and health problems, heart attacks, strokes, because it makes your vascular system more rigid. It builds up in your, hardens your arteries. But now there may be another reason to stay away from salt. A recent study on rodents and cultured cells show that dietary salt may help promote a variety of autoimmune diseases, including multiple sclerosis and inflammatory bowel disease. Yep, salt. Study findings suggest that salt promotes the specialization of cells called Th17 cells. It's a kind of immune cell. And while these kind of immune cells protect us from things like bacteria and fungi, they have also been identified in illnesses such as inflammatory bowel disease, multiple sclerosis, and psoriasis. Th17 cells mature from unspecialized T cells and depending on their influences, they can either be beneficial to the body or they can be destructive. Researchers at the Yale School of Medicine found that people who admitted to eating a lot of fast food had more Th17 cells. And as we all know, fast food contains lots and lots of salt. So to find out whether it was the salt that was the culprit and the increased level of Th17 cells, the researchers spiked cultures, cells in petri dishes, of unspecialized T cells with sodium chloride, table salt. The results were alarming. A modest increase in the amount of salt increased the number of Th17 cells that matured in cultures nearly 10 times. And these cells began to make inflammation-promoting molecules, which means they were the bad type of Th17 cells, not the good type. Inflammation, by the way, is also associated with the development of cancer. The researchers then tested whether this effect occurred naturally in animals. They prompted mice to develop EAE, a neurological illness similar to MS that's fostered by the bad type of Th17 cells. Some of the mice were fed meals that contained about as much salt as a typical Western diet. When compared with mice that lived on a low-sodium diet, the mice that consumed the high-salt Western diet developed EAE, this mouse version of multiple sclerosis, sooner and had more severe symptoms. The medical implications of these findings could be unprecedented. Cases like autoimmune diseases like MS, type 1 diabetes, have risen dramatically over the last few decades, and large intakes of salt could help explain this trend. So while some scientists still need to confirm whether salt is a definite factor in human autoimmune diseases, it's safe to say that something that has already been proven to promote heart attacks, strokes, obesity, and high cholesterol probably should be avoided. Put away the salt shaker now. Okay, Shano has this clip that he's been he loves this thing, and we got to share this with you. This is Senator Byron Dorgan back in what year was it, Shane? Back in 1999, as they were debating passing the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which blew up Glass-Steagall. Okay, so let's get in Mr. Peabody's Wayback Machine here and go back to 1999 as Congress is about to blow up Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall, keep in mind, was the law that said there's two kinds of banks, the kind that has a checking and savings accounts and writes mortgages, and the kind that does gambling, like, you know, used to be Merrill Lynch was the gambling kind and Bank of America was the banking kind. And Glass-Steagall said there's a wall, firewall between the two. No bank can do both these things. And what Gramm-Leach-Bliley did was it blew up that wall. It did away with Glass-Steagall so that your average bank where you keep your checking account can now be gambling in the back room, and the professional gambling banks could start offering checking accounts. And here's what Byron Dorgan had to say about that.
A philosopher and author once said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it."
Hang on just a second here.
Fusing together of the idea of banking, which requires not just safety and soundness to be successful, but the perception of safety and soundness, but to merge it with inherently risky, speculative activity is, in my judgment, unwise. There are some notions that represent transcendental truths that are true over time. And one of those, in my judgment, I fervently believe, is that we are, with this piece of legislation, moving towards greater risk. We are almost certainly moving towards substantial new concentration and mergers in the financial services industry. That is almost certainly not in the interest of consumers. And we are deliberately and certainly with this legislation moving towards inheriting much greater risk in our financial services industries. And so I come to the floor to say that I regret that I cannot support the legislation. I think we will, in 10 years' time, look back and say we should not have done that because we forgot the lessons of the past.
It was 1999. 2009, we're looking back and saying, damn, shouldn't have done that. And they still haven't undone it. They still haven't undone it. The Republicans in Congress and a few of the Democrats, so deeply in the pockets of these multi-billionaire banksters, have not been willing or able to say, let's put Glass-Steagall back into law. I'm not even talking about breaking up the big banks. I'm not talking about prosecuting the banksters. I'm all in favor of both those things. I'm talking about just a very simple requirement that says your bank has to choose. Which kind of bank are you going to be? Are you going to be a gambling bank? Are you going to do, you know, stocks and bonds and derivatives and tranche securities and all that? Are you going to do that? You going to be a place where rich people put their money in hopes of seeing it grow, but they realize that there's risk? Or are you going to be the kind of bank where people put their paycheck every month and they shuttle 5-10% aside for their savings account and they have their family's mortgage for their home? Which kind of bank are you going to be? The checkbook bank, it's called a commercial bank, or the gambling bank, it's called an investment bank? You can't be both. And in 1935, Franklin Roosevelt said to all the banks, and it was a lot easier, I suppose, back then, because all the banks had collapsed. But he basically said to all the banks, as you reinvent yourselves, you have to pick. And we need to be saying that again. It's time to bring back Glass-Steagall. 27 minutes past that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dear Senator Paul, says the Attorney General, the answer to that question is no. You cannot kill an American not engaged in combat on Earth. So, Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. So much going on. I promised you before the break I would share with you my thoughts on Rand Paul's filibuster yesterday. We talked about this on the air. I went on at some length about how the president does not have the power, should not have the power, should not be asserting the power to execute people without due process, which my interpretation of Eric Holder's previous letter said, yeah, he thinks he has that power. Extraordinary circumstances, of course, but he has that power. And if this president thinks he has that power, the next president will think he or she has that power, and the next president may or may not be such a good person. We can debate, you know, how good a person Obama is, but that's, you know, there have been some, and there continue to be, some really serious crazy people running for president of the United States. So anyhow, Eric Holder sends a letter to the Honorable Rand Paul, United States Senate, Washington, D.C., dated March 7th, which would be, what, yesterday? No, that's today, Thursday, March 7th. Dear Senator Paul, it has come to my attention. You think? You think somebody walked down the hall and kicked Eric Holder's chair and said, hey, wait, my friend. Yeah. Oh, man. How could you have said, yes, we can kill it? You know, so Eric Holder writes, it has come to my attention that you have now asked an additional question. Does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on American soil? End quote. The answer, writes Eric Holder, the answer to that question is no. Sincerely, Eric H. Holder, Jr. Interesting signature. I've never known if there's anything to this handwriting analysis stuff. I think there probably is. But he has everything is all kind of tightly contained. It's really remarkable. So anyhow, no. Now the president, now the White House, now the administration is saying, no. We're not going to kill Americans on American soil. And this was my rant yesterday, was that, you know, it used to be the tinfoil hat crazies who were saying, the government's going to kill you. The government's coming to get us. And first they take our guns, then they're going to take us out. And I would be saying to them, what are you, nuts? Give me some proof. And they'd say, oh, well, I heard it on shortwave radio. I heard it I read it on this blog that was, you know, the tinfoilhats.com. That's where I read it, you know. And you could kind of make fun of these folks. And then the president of the United States or his spokesman, the head of the Justice Department, Eric Holder, comes out and says, oh, yeah, we can kill people on U.S. soil with drones. Sure. And all hell breaks loose and Rand Paul goes to the floor of the Senate. Now, let's call this what it was. This was not a real filibuster. This was a stunt. Filibusters block the Senate from doing business. The Senate was not doing business, so arguably this was a filibuster, but Rand Paul could just as easily have had one of his aides send an email to Harry Reid saying, I don't want you to go forward with this. This was all about blocking the nomination of John Brennan to be the head of the CIA, saying, I don't want you to, I'm going to officially filibuster the nomination. I'm not going to allow a vote. He didn't have to go to the floor. This is the thing. People think that this is a filibuster. In a way, Rand Paul doing this was a good thing, in as much as 2 years from now, the next time Harry Reid has an opportunity to say, this is how filibusters actually have to be done, Harry Reid can say, this is how filibusters actually have to be done. Because right now, as I said, Rand Paul didn't have to do this. He could have filibustered John Brennan's nomination just as easily with an email to Harry Reid's aide, from his aide to Harry Reid's aide, which is how it's usually done, or a phone call. You know, I'm blocking this. And it can even be done secretly. I'm blocking this, and I don't want anybody to know my name. Happens all the time. Happens way too often. Shouldn't happen at all. But what was really going on yesterday was Rand Paul was saying that he was seriously in the running for president of the United States on the Republican ticket in 2016. That's what he was saying. And when he talked for an hour without taking a sip of water in the first hour, he was saying it to Marco Rubio. Hey, Marco, you think you're the guy who's going to be the Republican nominee? Watch this. You can't go 6 minutes without a sip? I can go an hour. It sounds silly, but I'm not kidding you. And by the way, you know, Holder's answer, which everybody is now Rand Paul is saying, well, thank you for that clarification. So you guys are walking back. You know, basically what Holder is saying is, You know, this is a highly qualified. If the, does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat? So the question is, what is engaged in combat mean? And this is that gray area that still has not been answered. And by the way, answering it is the job of Congress, not the White House. The Constitution says that we are at combat, in combat, when the legislative branch, the House and the Senate, have agreed on a declaration of war. It has passed both houses by a majority vote, and it has been sent to the president for his signature. That's what the Constitution says. There has been no declaration of war against al-Qaeda or by al-Qaeda, to the best of my knowledge. They're not a state actor. They don't have the ability to do that. What we have are a bunch of criminals around the world. And they should be dealt with our law enforcement authority and apparatus and tracked down and put in jail. I mean, you know, when political groups go rogue, we saw this with the Weather Underground on the left. We've seen this with the militia movement on the right in the United States. These groups go rogue. What happens? The bad actors get taken out through, you know, people blow up buildings. People, you know, plan to assassinate people. They get arrested. They get prosecuted by, you know, a court of law, and they go to jail. It's real simple. It's very straightforward stuff. And you know, and not just in the United States, by the way. Whether it was the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany in the 1960s and 70s, or maybe it was the 80s, whenever it was, somewhere in there. Or whether it was the Black Hand group in Germany, or whether it was what was the Italian group that kidnapped Aldo Moro? Red Brigades? Whether it was the Red Brigades? Whether it was the IRA, the Irish Republican Army in Ireland? You know, they nearly killed the Prime Minister of England, Maggie Thatcher. They blew up the building right next to number 10 Downing Street, and she was in, you know, number 10 Downing Street. They almost blew up Maggie Thatcher. They actually did kidnap and kill the former Prime Minister of Italy. Not the IRA, but the Red Brigades. None of those groups, none of those countries said, oh, we're declaring war on these groups. We're going to start bombing the neighborhoods that they're living in. Now, you could argue that England, the United Kingdom, did send the military into Northern Ireland, and they did, and there was a military occupation going on there. Louise and I drove around Belfast one day back in the mid-80s and got basically run out of that part of town by a half-track with a machine gun mounted on the back of it. We wandered into the wrong neighborhood. And that was like dancing up to that line. They danced up to the edge of it. But I would argue they didn't go over it because the IRA now has a representative in the British Parliament. I mean, there's been this transition because it wasn't an act of war. They were going after criminals. And we need to be saying 9/11 was a criminal act. It was not an act of war. It was an act of crime. And the people who put it together, the people who perpetrated it, needed to be arrested and tried. And to invade Afghanistan after the Taliban offered to arrest Osama bin Laden and turn him over to a third country for prosecution if he was involved in 9/11 was stupid. Invading Afghanistan was stupid and wrong. Invading Iraq was not only stupid and wrong, it was a war crime. So now the question, okay, so we can use drones against American citizens who are engaged in combat on American soil. What is combat? We need a clarification. You would think between the Korean conflict, the Korean War, Harry Truman justified this as a police action. Lyndon Johnson justified the Vietnam War as a police action, and then the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution as we were fired upon, so let's fire back. But the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was not a declaration of war. There was never a formal declaration of war with the Vietnam War. There was never a formal, you know, we have been lacking declarations of war since World War II. So there has been no combat. There's no authority for the president to go after anybody, in my humble opinion. So let's clarify this stuff. And it's up to Congress to clarify, because frankly, I think Congress has muddied the waters with the NDAA and the Patriot Act. It's time to make some of this stuff clear.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And to the extent that Congress has given way too much power to the executive branch to play judge, jury, and executioner with the Patriot Act and the NDAA, we need to undo those things. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And congratulations to the winner of our copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. His copy is being sent out by Stamps.com today, so how cool is that? Ah, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. And that picture may well have been taken by Ellen Ratner. She might even be in it. Go to GoatsForTheOldGoat.com for all the information. Ellen, welcome.
Thank you. I usually do take those photos, usually not in it, though. But several things going on. First of all, Speaker Boehner had a press conference today. He was asked about Bob Ney and what Bob Ney said about him, and he responded that Bob Ney was a disgraced congressman who went to jail and that these are baseless and false accusations. Of course, the reporter did not follow up, and it wasn't one of our people, well, did you offer him a deal or not? That's all he would say. Now, as you know, you gave the speech last night that introduced Bob Ney at his book party, but as you know, Bob Ney isn't about to make this kind of stuff up. And as Bob Ney pointed out when we asked him about it later, that Mr. Boehner is third in line for the presidency of the United States. People have a right to know about how he makes decisions, what kind of deals he makes, and if he's drinking.
Yeah, and apparently he's drinking a lot.
Right. Yeah. And everybody knows that in Washington, D.C. That's not a surprise. Okay, so now let's go on to the Brennan nomination. This is Mr. Brennan to be CIA director. Today, from the podium at the White House, we all listened, and there was a letter read by Jay Carney, the press secretary, from the Attorney General Holder, saying basically that no, Americans would not be droned. I just made up a verb.
Yeah, you did.
Drone in the United States. They wouldn't be droned. Okay. So, then he was really pushed on this, and Jay Carney said, well, technology is not the issue. It doesn't matter whether you're going after somebody with a bullet or a drone. You have to obey the law. Okay, fine. Later on, though, there is this vote on Mr. Brennan, and, of course, he did, in fact, get confirmed. He had three senators voting against him, the two from Vermont and Jeff Merkley of Oregon, who you know quite well. And Patrick Leahy said that he was voting against the nomination because the administration, and this is what's so shocking from a Democratic senator, has stonewalled the Judiciary Committee for too long on a reasonable request to review the legal justification for the use of drones in targeted killing of American citizens. Now, they did not say American soil. He said American citizens. And he said, I will reluctantly oppose Mr. Brennan's nomination.
Wow.
That's really quite, in Washington speak, honestly, Tom, you know as well as I know, that's quite a shocking statement.
Especially from somebody as senior and as powerful as Pat Leahy.
Right.
I mean, he's and this is a guy who was a federal prosecutor before he became a senator. He's not one of these bomb throwing crackpots. I mean, verbal bomb throwing crackpots like we saw some of the people. And I'm not talking about the Democrats, but some of the Tea Partier guys who joined Rand Paul yesterday, or Rand Paul for that matter, who will just any old thing might pop out of his mouth and he's going to have to walk it back. It's like Pat Leahy is thoughtful, deliberative. He used to be my senator when I lived in Vermont, and you just don't get anybody who's more, conservative, I guess is the word. I mean, he's a very careful, thoughtful, a deliberative former federal prosecutor who doesn't say things that he doesn't, that he hasn't given a lot of thought to. That's astounding. Anyhow, moving along.
So I think that that has certainly been an interesting thing today. Okay. Now, there is also the issue of North Korea. Now, as you know, they have threatened to go to war again. They've threatened now today. They're threatening to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Well, the United States and everybody else, a unanimous vote on the Security Council, no abstentions, no nothing. They basically were, the sanctions against North Korea are that any sporting cars, rubies, boats, any luxury item that could go to the elite ruling party in North Korea is to not be allowed.
Well, that's allowed in. This is hitting Kim Jong-un where he lives.
That's exactly right, in luxury land.
Yeah, yeah. No more entertaining Dennis Rodman, because that caviar is not going to be available to you anymore.
Exactly. And that, you know, essentially if you violate that, just like if you violate saying something, you could be in very big trouble. So
and Russia and China signed on for this.
They did.
Yeah, especially China. That's good news. They're it looks like they're cutting loose their I lack the word, but carbuncle.
Well, I think they're worried about some of this, and they're worried about them withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Yeah. I mean, they don't need to have a crazy neighbor on their backyard.
Well, I think China's big concern is that the crazy neighbor might melt down or start a war or something, and they're going to end up with 2 million starving, you know, North Koreans pouring into China.
Coming over the border.
Right.
On the cold ice in the winter.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's sort of number one on that front. And this is really in response to that nuclear test on February 12th that everybody was so concerned about. This also encompasses any technology and material. Okay, again on the United Nations, which came out today, apparently there's 21 people who the Syrian rebels were peacekeepers from the Philippines that the Syrian rebels have captured and aren't letting go, and they're United Nations personnel.
Well,
Amafor got a word, and now they're saying, well, you can pick them up at the border.
Huh. That's very interesting. Very interesting development. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Check it out. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you.
Great talking to you, as always. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, too big to jail, too big to fail. The Attorney General of the United States has come out and said, we were talking earlier about how Eric Holder's making news. I mean, this is the hit parade. He said, we're not going to kill anybody with a drone inside the United States unless they're engaged in combat. What the heck does combat mean? We've killed a lot of people without having declarations of war. The last formal declaration of war that we had was in 1941. Last time. That got resolved with the Potsdam Treaty? What was the treaty that finally ended World War II? I know the Treaty of Versailles ended World War I, but there were two of them. There were two different, you know, there was the end of the war in Europe, and then there was, which I'm not even sure there was a treaty associated with that. There was, you know, there was certainly, you know, what came out of that was a variety of things, Bretton Woods and others. But then there was actually a signing ceremony on an aircraft carrier with the Emperor of Japan after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I'm not sure how it's referred to. In any case, that was the end of that declaration of war. And we have not had any declarations of war since then. So why are we using drones to kill people again in Pakistan? And why could that legal reasoning that we're using to kill American citizens in the Middle East or in North Africa? Why could that logic not be applied to the United States? So you get that. And then you got Eric Holder basically saying, you know, we can't, at some point these banks are too big for us to prosecute. It becomes too difficult for us to prosecute. Now, what he's talking about, I believe, he did not elaborate on exactly why, but I think that really what he's saying is that the Justice Department only has so many lawyers. And when you've got a bank that's throwing off $10, $20, $30 billion in profits, they can easily hire enough lawyers to tie the Justice Department up in knots. This is what Thomas Jefferson referred to back, you know, at the founding of this country when he talked about wealth that was so great it posed a danger to democracy, that it posed a danger to the state, actually, was his phrase. And he felt that the power of taxation ought to be used to reduce that wealth to the point where it no longer represented a danger to the state. At that time, I mean, he was thinking of wealthy individuals, because the word corporation isn't even in the Constitution. I mean, you just didn't have modern corporations at that time. The modern corporate form really took, you know, came into being after the Civil War with the railroads and the steel companies. And I mean, to a large extent, it was created by John Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. But basically, they have so many lawyers and so much money that they can keep the Justice Department at arm's length for so long that the Justice Department, the Justice Department ends up saying, nah, okay, we're not going to take you to trial. It would cost us a fortune. It would take years. We'll just settle with you. Give us a couple $1 billion. We know that you committed crimes, that people lost their homes, that people committed suicide, that people got divorced, that people probably committed homicides as a consequence of the stress associated with this. Families went down in flames. Kids died. People, you know, we know all that, but just, and you made $100 billion on it, but give us $20 billion and we'll call it even. And that's what the Justice Department has been doing since the banks first started to fail in 2008. In fact, it arguably has been doing forever. Not forever. Since 1986, the last serious effort by the Justice Department to prosecute banksters was when the S&Ls fell apart in 1986 as a result of Reagan having deregulated them 4 years earlier. And the Reagan administration's Justice Department actually prosecuted S&L banksters. But at that time, I mean, the S&Ls were not that large. Neil Bush, George W. Bush's brother, made $1 million in the Silverado savings and loan deal, or so the lore goes, and never got prosecuted. Of course, he was, son of the vice president. Yes, we're going to prosecute the son of the vice president. That's going to look really good. I mean, I think it should have been done, but the Republicans didn't. The administration didn't. So Neil got away with it. Now he's running an education program. Yeah, let's skim off some of that education money. Cool. So Eric Holder basically admitting that the banks are too big to be prosecuted. They're too big to jail, which is what Elizabeth Warren has been saying all along. The system is rigged. These guys own this system. And that leaves us with what as choices? I think we have a couple, and I think we should be pursuing both of them. With regard to these big banks, and I would, by the way, not limit this to banks, or at least not limit the second part of this to banks. I think it needs to be done in every single industry in America, but to banks. The first thing we need to do is say, you have to pick which kind of bank you're going to be. Are you going to be a gambling bank, or are you going to be a checkbook bank? An investment bank or a commercial bank? Which are you going to be? In other words, reinstate Glass-Steagall, because Byron Dorgan was absolutely right in 1999 when he said that 10 years from now, it didn't even take 10 years, took 8 years. But he said 10 years from now, we're going to be looking back at this moment and saying we shouldn't have done this. Yep. When Graham Leach Bliley was passed and Glass-Steagall was blown up. So you have to, with regard to the banks, make a choice. Are you an investment bank or a passbook savings bank? Number one. And number two, let's start using the Sherman Antitrust Act. These big banks, and to break up these big banks are big, not because they have done wonderful service or great things over the years, or they just, you know, so they're big because they bought up all their competitors. Every single one of these giant banks are giant banks because of the result of mergers and acquisitions. They all got that way because of Mitt Romney's industry. What used to be called the LBO industry, the M&A industry, mergers and acquisitions, leveraged buyouts, pirate capital, pirate equity, private equity, you name it, whatever you want to call it, Mitt Romney's industry made these banks and these banksters too big to jail. Too big to fail, too big to jail. And it's not just the banksters. When giant food companies poison people and people die, nobody from the giant food companies goes to jail. When giant oil companies blow up people hundreds, thousands of cases of cancer come about as a result of it, and entire ecosystems are wiped out, nobody goes to jail. Well, I understand, you know, BP now is trying to toss a couple of low-level flunkies to the wolves, as it were. Maybe one or two people will go to jail out of that. Right. And Tony, what's his name? Is it Tony Hayward? Howard? Hayward, yeah. Yeah. Tony Hayward, the head of BP, he's like, you know, he's sitting in his mansion someplace. He's probably sitting on the beach in the south of France right now. Come on. Let us do what Presidents Roosevelt and Taft, two Republicans, did at the beginning of the 19th century and start breaking up these big industries, whether it's in the agricultural sector, whether it's in the media sector, whether it's in the banking sector, whether it's in the telecom sector, whether it's in the publishing sector, whether it's in the retail sector, whether it's in manufacturing, whether it's in defense. I mean, you name it. Pick an industry. Fast food. Pick an industry. They are all dominated by fewer than six companies. That's wrong.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's not just wrong because of some kind of moral code. It's wrong because it's bad for the country and it's bad for capitalism. Welcome back. So, John Brennan has been confirmed as director of the CIA. Rand Paul, to be bombed in your sleep, there's nothing American about that. There's nothing constitutional about that. Very, very interesting. There's quite a montage of photos. Well, they're starting to show up all over the place, but there's quite a montage of them over at Huffington Post from an AP photo collection. Pretty grim stuff. These are all little kids who have been wounded or killed by drone strikes. Our drone strikes. Your and my drone strikes. Yes, we're going to get the bad guys. Well, okay. You want to get the bad guys? Use the police. Jay in Oswego, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Jay.
Yes, sir.
You want to talk about Rand Paul's filibuster?
I do a little bit, you know. There's so much you covered, though. I do agree with you about NDAA, of course, tying into all this. There's just a culmination of events here that have to be questioned. And you're right, the waters need to be cleared up here. They've definitely been muddied. But, you know, a couple of us were talking about this morning, and I think I've got my answer. Taking a look at Rand Paul's stand, two things surfaced then. Well, you know, it's a shame that he's the only guy that's the voice of many Americans. The second was, is this just a ploy? Is this a game afoot here, a wag the dog? Because once people believe someone's fighting for them, resolution, whatever it may be, they're more accepting of it. You know, why?
Yeah, this is just a stunt. Rand Paul did this as a stunt. He did not need to go to the floor of the Senate. His speaking all those hours did absolutely nothing in terms of stopping, slowing down, changing the course of, or anything else, the nomination of John Brennan. and or the ratification of that nomination, the approval of that nomination by the Senate. But the you know, what it did, what Rand Paul did yesterday was he kicked off his 2016 presidential campaign. And when I pointed out that he kicked it off, you know, and he talked for an hour without taking a sip of water, he was shoving it in Marco Rubio's face. And so that's why Marco Rubio jumped in. Marco Rubio also stepped up to the podium and said, I want to say something, too. And he talked for a little while without drinking water. So, you know, it was a stunt. Let's acknowledge that. But at the same time, it brought into public consciousness the discussion of our drone policy and a very legitimate and necessary debate over how far the executive branch can go and what constitutes an attack and what constitutes an act of war and what constitutes an enemy and an enemy combatant and all those things, the definitions of all those things. And after 9/11, when the Bush administration pulled out the Patriot Act, which had been written years and years earlier by right-wingers and the neocons, and they'd been trying to push this thing for years, and nobody would have it. And they brought out this Patriot Act, and they said, here we go, we're going to push it. It had to go through Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy, because the Democrats controlled the Senate in 2001, I guess it was, or maybe it was early 2002, whenever this happened. And it had to get through those two guys to pass the Senate. And those two guys were inclined to say no. They were both making public statements that Pat Leahy was not going to let the Patriot Act out of committee. He thought that there was some real big problems with it. And Tom Daschle, who was then the majority leader of the Senate, who determines the calendar, the agenda, what comes before the Senate, was not going to bring it before the entire Senate for a vote. And those two guys were the only guys in the entire United States who were elected officials who got weaponized anthrax in the mail in their offices. And to this day, we do know that weaponized anthrax came from a U.S. Army facility. We know that, but that's all we know.
Tom, am I still on here?
You still are.
Okay, I couldn't tell. You know, I wanted to also mention, I mean, I guess we already covered the fact that rhetoric really gave us no answer. Obviously, no American's probably going to be in combat within our continental United States. I mean, it's like a false statement in itself.
Well, maybe, maybe not. I think that there are
martial law, right? Unless it's martial law, that's the next question. If we're reacting to martial law, then they won't use drones on us. Is that what they're saying? They'll just take us to FEMA camp?
Well, the Bush administration basically, and the Obama administration for that matter, you know, in some of these things where they've set up these people and, you know, they got this ragtag band down in Miami to say, oh yeah, you know, we're going to swear loyalty to Osama bin Laden. And by the way, can we have some shoes? There had been claims at various times that some of these people were actually enemy combatants, not just criminals. And therefore they could be tried by the military. They could be questioned without counsel. I don't know to what extent that has happened in individual cases. I think most of the people that's happened to have been people that were captured in Afghanistan or taken, you know, someplace else in the world and ended up in Guantanamo. But we're damn close to that line right now, Jay.
Well, let me, one last thing to interject. You mentioned earlier IBM. I couldn't help but weigh in on Herman Hollerith. That's what you were talking about, right? The Hollerith machine.
Yes.
Used to tag the Jews. And I want to make a point here about RFID chips and that technology in our midst. And that IBM is behind this as well, and that we need to take a look at it. And this is the future tagging of the new Jew of today, which is conceivably anyone that's not an elitist will be tagged with the RFID chip. You've got IBM funding Applied Digital, who became Digital Angel, who then became Verichip, and then became Positive ID, and now is Veritech privately held. And I think that we need to examine what's going on. You've heard about the RFID bracelets in Texas schools?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that IBM's still playing that role here. There's
Getting RFID chips now. You're getting them in credit cards. You're getting them in driver's licenses. I mean, I would say probably within 5 to 10 years, pretty much everybody who engages in commerce in any significant way, in other words, who has a credit card, who has a driver's license, certainly they've been in our passports now for several years, 4 or 5 years. If you got a crowd of people, 50, 100, 200 people standing outside, you know, the headquarters of IBM or, for that matter, the headquarters of the Pentagon protesting, somebody can drive by with a car and just scan the crowd and instantly know every single person who's in that group. know their name, know their address, know their social security number, know their credit history, know where they live, and then by looking at their use of credit cards, they can know what, you know, what they have eaten for the last 6 months. And, I mean, we're already there. So, yeah, I'm with you, Jay. It's time for us to have some common sense limits on the power of Big Brother, and not just government Big Brother, but corporate Big Brother as well. Jay, thanks.
Thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I realize that, you know, at times this kind of wanders into the area of the, you know, right-wing tinfoil hat shortwave radio, but there are real concerns here. The bad and the very, very scopolagnially ugly. There we go. Finally got it. The good. Nancy Pelosi. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi took a stand with the American workers Thursday when she announced her support for raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. As Pelosi herself acknowledged, the middle class's share of the economy is shrinking even as stock prices balloon. Something needs to be done. Maybe she was inspired by our ongoing coverage of the minimum wage debate. Regardless, it's high time House Dems fought back against the stagnation that's bringing us all down. Nancy Pelosi, keep working for the maximum good. The bad. Greg Gutfeld. Fox So-Called News' resident troglodyte, Greg Gutfeld, reached a new low for his contemptible standards Wednesday night, calling climate change protesters Islamists and primitives. Apparently, expressing concern for the health of the planet is the new Inquisition. Watch out before fuel efficiency standards reduce us all to slavery! As with anything broadcast from Fox, it's hard to tell whether Gutfeld's remarks were serious or just the ramblings of a cynical troll or maybe even satire. But when, like Greg, you mock concerned citizens, the same day scientists report the highest spike in CO2 levels in 15 years, your sense of humor is just bad. And the very, very ugly Roger Ailes. The Fox So-Called News chief found himself in another controversy Wednesday after sections of his memoir that called President Obama a lazy leech were published in Vanity Fair. In a section defending his friend Ann Romney against claims of privilege, Ailes writes, "Obama's the one who's never worked a day in his life. He never earned a penny that wasn't public money. How many fundraisers does he attend every week? How often does he play basketball and golf? I wish I had that kind of time. He's lazy, but the media won't report that." Classy stuff, huh? Excuse me. Isn't it great when people reveal their true selves? We all knew Roger wasn't exactly the biggest fan of the president. But now we know that his views are just plain racist. No questions asked. Questioning Obama's policies is one thing. Recycling old racial myths to sell your book, that's very, very ugly. Excuse me. I should have taken a drink during the last break. Not a John Boehner drink, just water. Need to put some of that vitamin C stuff in there. Anyhow. Ooh, somebody disagrees with me. Okay. Meyer in Macon, Georgia. What do you disagree about, Meyer? You want to put troops on the ground in Macon, Georgia? Meyer? Oh, come on. If you're going to call and disagree with me, you have to at least listen to your damn phone. Tommy in Peachtree City, Georgia. Hey, Tommy, you wanted to talk about Cuba.
Yes. Earlier in the program, you talked about everyone not being hungry and having health care.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to disagree with you and inform you that 70 to 80% of the Cuban populace lives in poverty, and their average weekly salary is $21.
Yeah. And they all have health care, and they all have free education, and they all have subsidized housing, and they all have access to a good public transportation system. So do you incorporate any of those, the value of any of those things into that wage? I'm guessing not. I'm guessing you're using right-wing numbers.
No. It was done by a professor from Havana University, and it's on Progressive Weekly.
Right. Okay. if you're saying that people are earning $21 and they have full health care and they're able to pay for that with that $21, then your numbers are wrong.
The article from progressiveweekly.com,
right,
by a professor from the Havana School of Economics,
right,
concludes that the majority of the Cuban people don't have enough for the basic food, living, and transportation needed.
Yeah. Well, one letter by one guy who claims to be one professor from, I'm not buying it. I'm just not buying it. I'm sorry. I'm sure that there's a lot of poverty in Cuba. We have imposed a brutal embargo on that country for the better part of, since the late 1950s. It's been 60 years? Nearly? 50 years, anyway. 50 years. We've had this incredible embargo on them. And, so basically what they have is what they can grow and what they can mine, and now increasingly maybe what they can drill. So it's been tough for the Cuban people. We've made it tough for the Cuban people. But when their billionaires left, they did not fall apart for lack of billionaires. Kirk, which was the original point that we had made. Kirk in Bothell, Washington, listening on 91.3 FM KBCS. Hey, Kirk, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I think we might be getting closer to reaching critical mass politically in this country than we might realize. I heard a really encouraging conversation this morning on NPR between Sheila Bair, a Bush appointee who held over in the Obama administration, and Katrina Vandenhoevel about income inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly, Sheila Bair is for a financial transactions tax, which she said the Obama administration actually lobbied against when Dodd-Frank was being put together.
Mm-hmm.
She believes that we need to create an infrastructure bank, that the middle class needs to dramatically increase its earning power, and that people who sit on their butts collecting the dividend check, as you like to say, are destroying the country. And she believes, as you have said, that we're also on the verge of another bubble.
Yeah.
She said the economy is probably going to just bumble along or collapse anytime soon if things aren't changed. So
yeah, I give it a year and a half.
Yeah, I really hope that maybe somebody as influential as she is can, influence other people who respect her intellect there in that party.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath. But because the billionaires control the Tea Party, and the Tea Party has become the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party, and the billionaires are not letting go, we've got some folks who just, there's the word enough is not part of the vocabulary. They want more, 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 more. The top 1% since 2009 has gotten more than 100% of the gains in income in the United States, which means that because it's more than 100%, it means that everybody in the bottom 99% has actually seen their income go down since then. And still these guys are complaining about how much taxes they're paying. And they even got some writer for the Associated Press to write a piece about, the poor rich and all this kind of stuff. But Kirk, hope springs eternal. And, thanks for listening to KBCS. Spencer, watching Free Speech TV in Fort Collins, Colorado. You wanted to talk about, it's interesting, MS?
Yeah, Tom, I live in Fort Collins, and Northern Colorado has the highest rate of MS in the country.
Multiple sclerosis.
I don't know why. They've never figured it out here, but I wonder if somebody done a survey to see if we eat more salt here. But we're ranked as Colorado's come out as the second happiest state in the country next to Hawaii, and we're by far the healthiest,
yeah,
the least obese. And Fort Collins itself is ranked number 4 in the country for a city its size. Boulder's number 2. It's only 45 miles away. And yet, Northern Colorado has the highest rate of MS in the United States.
I wonder if there's if your water is saline. Do you have any idea what the salinity of your water is, or salt is in your water?
It doesn't taste like it. I don't think so. It's. I mean, we got clear Rocky Mountain water.
Yeah.
Snow melt. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's pretty strange.
Yeah, it is. I don't have an answer for that one, Spencer. I don't know. But thanks for the tip and the statistic. Vi in Ripon, California. How do you say it?
Ripon. Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Vi.
I 2 points today that the RT program made. One, that the Supreme Court has granted President Obama the right to use drone strikes within our border.
In which decision?
Pardon?
In which Supreme Court decision was he given that right?
It just happened today. I only caught part of it, but that's what it was said. Robert,
I believe, Vi, that you have information in error. We keep really close track of what's going on in the Supreme Court, and I don't think there were even any decisions handed down today. Were there, Shay? They're not even in today. So I mean, you may be referring to Attorney General Holder, to the Justice Department.
No. They mentioned Robert specifically making the point for the drone strike.
Where'd you see this, Vi, or where'd you hear it?
It was a little over an hour ago today. I have DirecTV on channel 280.
Do you know what network that is, or what the source of that is? Because I'm, we're looking around for it. Okay, well, Vi, thank you for the tip. We're going to...
Wait,
yes, okay.
Another point.
All right.
They also mentioned about North Korea.
Right.
And here a few years ago, that President Obama, we have 60% of our Marine Force, right, in the Gulf.
I don't know. I don't know the statistics. But
we are forcing them into a war just like we are Iran.
Yeah. I don't think that we're trying to force a war on North Korea. I think that we're trying to crash the regime. There's no doubt about that. Vi, thank you, which may lead to a war. Vi, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, you know, North Korea is, you know, the little crackpot who could, I guess, Kim Jong-un and Dennis Rodman hanging out with. Occupy the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you and Jim in Elgin, Illinois. Hey, Jim, you were in Cuba a year ago?
Yes, Tom. I was with the Rhodes Scholar Program, and we went spent half of our time in Havana, half of our time in Cienfuegos, and we got to see the system. Now, I don't know about the $21 a week, but what we do know is everybody has free medical care. Everybody has food subsidies. Okay, there are stores that only Cubans can go into. They're very downscale, but you get milk, you get eggs, you get yogurt, you get flour, all the necessities that you can get. And if you are either a school child or a senior citizen who doesn't make the good health numbers, you get extra rations. And that's before you buy any food at the store.
Right.
Out of whatever you have.
Right. So, plus, everybody gets free education.
Right.
Plus, they have a relatively decent mass transit system, I understand. They have buses.
Right. And they have another little program that a lot of people aren't familiar with. If you are a government official driving a car and there is someone standing by the side of the road in the countryside, you must pick them up and take them along with you if they're going your way.
You must pick up hitchhikers.
Yes.
Amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a requirement, but I don't want to downplay the idea that many Cubans live in housing that would be substandard in the United States, except that their climate wouldn't, make them perish because of their substandard housing. But much of it is substandard.
Sure, sure. Well, like I said, we have had this embargo for 50 years on that country, and pretty much nothing has gone in or out that they can't grow themselves right there. They're still driving around cars made in the United States in the 1950s.
Right, and you can, but as a matter of fact, you cannot export those cars from Cuba. They're considered a national resource.
Well, they're probably quite valuable. They're antiques. They're collector's items.
Oh, yes. Yes, they are, which is the reason why you can't export them. And the other thing that I found most fascinating is there was absolutely no port security either in Havana or Cienfuegos. People came in on private boats who were obviously not Cubans. No one stopped them.
Hmm.
No one even asked for a docking fee.
So somebody could hop. If you had a 90 mile range, if you had enough fuel to go 90 miles in your boat or in your sailboat, could obviously easily do it. Out of Miami, you could just take your boat down to Havana. Nobody's going to stop you. Nobody's going to hassle you. Look around the country, have a good time, and then take your boat home.
I later talked to people in Key West where I was after I was in Cuba, and I said to someone on the QT, how often do you go to Cuba? And the guy said, oh, he said, we go over there once every 6 weeks or 8 weeks. And I said, did anybody ever stop you? He said, yeah, once in a while there's a guy there who says, why are you tying up? We gave him $2 American, and that was it. He said, but most of the time there's nobody.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing.
So much for the police state.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have heard that, you know, did you talk to anybody about Castro putting in prison people who were political dissidents?
We did talk about that, and people didn't really want to talk about that. But I can tell you this, in the time that we were there was about 10 days, we saw no military personnel whatsoever. I don't know where they were, but we didn't see them, and we did travel from one side of the island to the other. The other thing is that in Havana, it was very well policed by armed police officers walking the beat, and most of them were very attractive young women.
Hmm. Interesting.
So it felt very safe.
Yeah. Yeah. So our caller who basically called up and said that he read it in an article on a website that sounded like it was a progressive website that Cubans are listing. Oh, that's very interesting. Jim looked up the website that the caller was referring to, and it doesn't exist. So that caller was just blowing smoke at us. Incredible.
Yeah, but even if it is $21 a month, if you've got everything paid for in an economy where prices are sort of uniformly as low as in Cuba, if you had all this other stuff paid for, even if that's right, you would be in pretty good shape. I mean, you wouldn't be starving.
Yeah. The other thing that Castro has been doing the last couple of years is he's been experimenting with allowing limited capitalism, you know, small-scale entrepreneurialism. Actually, it's not capitalism. It's not people. It's not Mitt Romney coming in and investing in things.
No, it's free enterprise.
It's free enterprise, right, which is a different thing than capitalism.
They've been pushing it. They've been pushing it very, very strongly. One more thing before I go. I'll tell you, they don't reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
We went to a Roman Catholic leper colony that the nuns had been running for a long, long time.
Right.
And it is still run by them, but the government gives them a subsidy to run it because they don't want to have people who suffer from leprosy returned to rural areas where they would not be accepted. So they are allowed to stay there, and they have a little cottage industry for people to work in.
But leprosy can be treated with antibiotics. I know. It takes several years. It's very difficult to treat, but it's treatable.
There's a cultural thing about not getting them back into the regular society.
So these are people who were disfigured by leprosy but are no longer active lepers? I guess it must still be around.
They're not active, and many of them are not disfigured. It's just that once your community knows that you have it, if you're in a rural community, they really have this kind of old-school idea that people have had about leprosy.
Yeah. Well, it's biblical. I mean, it really is. That's remarkable. Jim, thanks for thanks for the history lesson.
All right.
Geography and everything else. Great to hear from you. We'll be back tomorrow. And, of course, tomorrow's Friday, which means it'll be Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here talking about all the important issues of the week and taking your calls as well. Plus, anything goes on Town Hall Friday, your chance to choose the topic and tell me what's on your mind. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires your participation. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Peg, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.